because you're just about to
Log Talk Radio
show that will change your life. And you're listening to the Dr. Pat Show that's coming up right next to you.
Welcome to the Dr. Pat Show. Talk radio to thrive by. Powerful, inspiring, and coming to you live, bringing you stories of people like you and me, busting through and living life full out. Get ready to dare to wonder what your life would be like if you knew you could not fail.
Hey, everybody, welcome. Look, I have done a series with PETA. I want you to know who PETA is. When you have this organization come to the forefront to bring a message, there is something in it that is an action for all of us. And today's show is even more important than you can imagine. And if you're wondering about PETA, you just go to PETA, PETA.org. Just go over, take a look. And what you're going to find are people dedicated to helping us understand and take action against abuse. Abuse for animals, abuse for what is completely unnecessary, and compassion is what we need to be looking at. But compassion without action doesn't save these beings. Today, I'm talking with somebody that is so passionate, Dr. Emily Trunnell. She's joining me here today, neuroscientist and research associate for PETA. But here's what I want to say. When humans hear the word sepsis, when you hear that word for a family member, you completely understand what is happening with them. You know the pain they're going through. You know, you've seen this in top television shows about what happens. But yet, you're completely unaware that your taxpayer dollars are being wasted on inhuman sepsis experiments on animals. You don't know that. But hopefully after today, you're going to be thinking, nope, we can't have this. Today, joining me, Dr. Emily, is going to share a personal experience. But even more importantly, you should know what sepsis is and why this is so cruel. Dr. Emily, thank you for joining me here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
When human beings are hear the word sepsis, when they hear that in their own diagnosis, the word itself brings people to their knees. But here we are, and we're talking about experimentation, and we're talking about creating something in the body of healthy animals that is beyond inhumane. It is unethical, and it is absolutely cruel. Tell us about this and tell us what's going on here and why you are involved in it.
Thank you. Yes, sepsis is, you're right. It's, you hear that and it just seems like something, you know, that's the most horrible thing that you can think of. And it is a terrible, painful condition. It affects 1.7 million American adults each year and kills almost 300,000 people a year in the U.S. So what sepsis is it's the body's overreaction to an infection. And this can be, you know, an infection that occurs when you have an injury, if you've gotten surgery, sometimes infections can occur, or even from other illnesses like pneumonia or kidney disease. So when you have these infections, the body, you know, releases chemicals to try to fight them. But in sepsis, that whole system gets overblown and you get inflammation throughout the body. It can quickly cause tissue damage and organ failure and even death. So it's a really important condition that we need to study, but despite decades and decades of research, there have been no new cures or treatments for sepsis. Physicians are using the same thing that they have been using for decades to treat sepsis, and nothing more effective has come to light. A major reason for this is because the NIH and other federal agencies continue to funnel billions of dollars into these horrific sepsis experiments on animals instead of using human-relevant methods.
Let's talk about alternatives because, you know, whenever I do a show like this, Dr. Emily, what happens is I get emails from people because we need to talk about what is and, you know, to be able to stop this. We have so many modernized research abilities now. We have learned so much about what we could learn about the body, and yet we still resort to this absolutely cruel and abuse to animals. So I would love to know from your perspective, you know, if you're a neuroscientist, you're somebody also that is compassionate about this. What are the alternatives to this? Tell us what we don't know.
Physicians have really been on the forefront of saying that sepsis needs to be studied using human biology as the gold standard.
Yeah.
So there are lots of methods that we can do that with, and some of those are, you know, in vitro experiments like you would think of in a petri dish, but you can actually collect cells directly from a human patient, you know, non-invasively, just like a skin scraping, and use those skin cells to study that patient's biology and how they might respond to treatment. You can also use sophisticated analysis of the wealth of human genome data that we now have, mathematical and computer modeling of human biology, donated human tissue, and other sophisticated in vitro methods that are based in the biology of humans and not in the biology of mice.
When I think about this, it's got to bring tears to your eyes. I mean, you know, let's just understand this for a minute. It's got to bring tears to your eyes. But let's talk about what the animal goes through. I mean, because we've got to just tell people that we're not just here speaking about something and just using language like abuse. There are things that when you create sepsis in anyone, but when you create sepsis in an animal being, an animal friend of ours, they go through things. Can you tell people what they're doing here? Please don't hold back.
Okay. I never know how much to say.
No, you need to be, on my show, you need to be direct, and we need to really paint a picture of this for people.
You're right. I mean, I, in my line of work at PETA, I look at a lot of animal experiments, and a lot of them are horrific, but sepsis really stands out.
Yep.
You know, these experiments, the experimenters will cut open a mouse's abdomen, take out their intestines and punch a hole in them with a needle and then sew them back up into the mouse's body. And so the bacteria leaks out and causes the systemic reaction. They inject deadly toxins directly into animals. And there have even been experiments where they have sewn two animals together so that they share a bloodstream. And they try to, you know, treat one animal and see if it will affect the other one. I mean, it's stuff, and you're right, these are otherwise healthy animals that they're inflicting all of this on. And it's something that you would expect to see more in a horror movie than in a biomedical lab.
And you know, what happens is it's like carte blanche. You know, I hate that term, but I got to use it. Because it's almost as if nobody's watching us, and why do you care anyway? And I think it doesn't stop here. You know, we are seeing, and, you know, by you all coming on, we're seeing across the board, you know, this, how should I call it, experimentation without control mechanisms. You know, there are no control mechanisms. It's like, yeah, let's just do it and research it and call it good for medicine. You know, what can be done? How can listeners find out more? And, you know, from your perspective, are animals even the right model to use? I mean, I'm trying to wrap my mind around this. You know, what do we get from experimentation on animals?
Well, in sepsis particularly, but in so many areas, we've gotten absolutely nothing. And you're right, there are not checks and balances in the system. You know, it's fueled by money, it's fueled by habit. And there was a study in 2013 that was, you know, 10 years of research, almost 40 researchers from respected institutions around the world found that mice use completely different genes to respond to sepsis than humans. And this is critically important when we're trying to develop, you know, sophisticated medicines to treat sepsis, but the fact that it's a completely different condition in mice. And 150 drugs developed in mice that treated sepsis in mice all failed in humans, 150 drugs, and that was, you know, 8 years ago, and it's more by this point. So other animals are not the right models to be studying what is a very specific disease in humans and even in each human patient.
I know these are short interviews, and I can only thank you for bringing the, you know, the word and bringing information to the forefront. But I also want to thank PETA, and for people out there, you know, we're talking about people for the ethical treatment of animals. Let me say it again. People for the ethical treatment of animals. That's PETA, P-E-T-A. And if you go to the website, PETA, P-E-T-A.org, not only will you find more information regarding what Dr. Emily is talking about, but you will find information here to become more aware. And, you know, what I love about this is we're watching the young people. We're watching people become so aware and then making the rest of us become more aware. Animals are not ours to abuse. That's not it. That's not what they're here for. And certainly they're not here for us to experiment on. Emily, last question. What's your personal message? What would you like to leave us with today? And, again, thank you for everything you're doing.
Thank you so much. And I just, as a scientist and a person who cares deeply about humans and animals, this area of animal experimentation is really a win-win for both causes, because shifting to human-relevant methods not only saves the lives of billions of animals every year, but will get treatment to humans more quickly and more efficiently. And so it's something that really can't be argued.
Thank you so much for everything. Thank you for what you're doing, and thank you for how you're doing it. Please keep up the good work.
Thank you so much.
Everyone, please, again, PETA.org. I'm Dr. Pat. Let's take a short break. We'll be right back.
Not just talk. Conversation for profound self-awareness. Stick with us. Your best life awaits on TransformationTalkRadio.com.
Okay, everybody, welcome. Welcome to our good news segment. Oh, look, this is a time where we get to laugh a little bit, because I think you all know exactly what I'm talking about. You know, when I'm thinking about a book and I'm thinking about what's going to make me laugh, but I know, I watch it, I'm seeing the blunders, I'm seeing the things happen in terms of ideas that are out in the world, and you ask yourself the question, what was that idea? What is the idea behind the idea? Well, I'm not going to answer that question, because I've got the author, Michael Smith. I've got the author of 100 of the worst ideas in history. Michael Smith and Eric Hessen wrote this book. And how does humanity survive the thundering, ridiculous aspects of some of the things we do? I mean, how do we even make it through it? You know, is it really just pure luck? My dad used to say, that's just dumb luck. Or are there facts that we should know about? Let's talk to Michael about this. Hey, welcome to the show.
Good to be here, Dr. Pan. Always a pleasure.
So, you know, let's talk about some of these, because, you know, as people, we see these ideas come to the forefront. And I could talk about great ideas that never made it forward, and the worst idea that I could think about had to do with my telephone experience. The worst idea goes so far back, it would have changed the landscape of the history of the phone company and the phone company AT&T. But let's talk about some of these worst ideas, because I think I may have been part of some of these.
Oh, no, really?
What was it?
You were part of the 100 worst ideas in history.
I think some of these, I look at some of these and I'm thinking, oh, my God, did I buy into that? Did I actually believe that? Because we believe some of the things we're told. Tell me what the backstory is for you in saying, look, I got to talk about some of these worst ideas in history, some of the blunders.
Well, it's, you know, my partner, Eric Kassim, and I are both, not surprisingly, writers. I run my own video advertising agency, and Eric is a former speechwriter for President George H.W. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
He's written for the L.A. Times, New York Times, CBS News. So we kick around ideas all day long, and we have a great appreciation for what it takes to come up with a good idea, and a lot of empathy when a seemingly good idea goes terribly wrong, because God knows we've done that ourselves.
Yeah.
So we went through our own personal Rolodex of bad ideas. We took about 3 years of research, and we kind of boiled it down to what Eric likes to call the creme de la creme of colossally bad thinking.
And I got to tell you, there are some in here that are obvious, and then there are others that just absolutely we know about, but
Sure.
We don't really talk about them. Do you have a favorite? Can I ask you? I have a couple in here that are my favorite, and
sure.
I definitely was part of the Corvair thing.
Oh God,
that bad idea.
Oh my gosh. That's an interesting one. We'll come back to that in a second,
okay.
If it's okay.
Yeah, let's get yours.
I really liked the skinny dipping president, and this goes back a few years, let's say, and it gives crack of dawn a whole new meaning, shall we say, because every morning President John Quincy Adams sneaks down to the Potomac, undresses, and proceeds to skinny dip with the ducks and geese, all the while, as we say, naked as a jaybird.
Oh wow!
So there's a newspaper reporter named Anne Royal. And she hears about it and hides out in the Potomac's foliage and catches the unsuspecting president in the buff. So she takes his clothes and holds them ransom until he agrees to give her a long-awaited interview he's put off. So he gets his clothes back. She gets the interview. And she doesn't mention his, shall we say, ballsy morning escapades. But soon word gets out, as it always does, in Washington. And now Adams is swimming, as we say, in a pool of national ridicule and shame. And as a result, the Adams administration's policy agenda stalls, and he's soundly defeated for re-election in 1828 by Andrew Jackson. And in the end, the electorate considered Adams' sagging credibility and sagging backside and concluded the president has no clothes.
I mean, you know, these are some of the things, and you have to wonder, you know, what's behind the idea. If I'm reading your book, I'm thinking to myself, what's behind the idea? And some of it I understand. You know, for example, the bad idea to protect the privacy of suspicious foreign operatives, you know, that
sure.
one there, you know,
mm-hmm.
surrounding, you know, 9/11. Clearly, some political aspect of it. But it's really hard to understand the Titanic, isn't it?
Oh, the Titanic is an interesting one, I can tell you about that. And it's actually a number of bad ideas that have kind of come together to form one gigantic bad idea. And obviously this goes back to April 14th of 1912 and the RMS Titanic. It's the fastest and biggest ship on Earth. And it's carrying at this time some of the richest people on Earth. And it, as we all know, it rams an iceberg at full speed and plunges into the icy depths of the North Atlantic, and more than 1,700 people die within minutes. Now, it's a disaster that, as we say in the book, has become iconic, but its story is really, to coin a phrase here, ironic, because it's the story, as I say, of one bad idea leading to another and another and another and another. So let me just run through them real quick here.
Sure.
A lot of people don't know all of these. There's five bad ideas that came together to bring this about. So the first bad idea is that the steel used in the construction of the Titanic is not really optimal. It contains a high amount of sulfur. And as a result, in the frigid waters of April in the North Atlantic, the ship's hull becomes increasingly brittle and all the more vulnerable to perforation by a shark or an object. The construction of the steel, that was the first bad idea. The second bad idea is a design defect. Sir Thomas Andrews is the ship's designer and architect, and he does not specify that roofs be placed on the, in quotes, watertight compartments. So as each compartment fills after iceberg impact, water flows over the tops of the walls, flooding the next compartment and the next and the next, and that basically doomed the ship. So roofs could have restrained the flooding water and might have saved the Titanic. Idea three, they had lookouts, guys up in the crow's nest, without binoculars. So on the night of the disaster, the two lookouts named Frederick Fleet and Reginald Lee, who, as I say, are high up in the crow's nest, and they're squinting into the darkness in a fruitless attempt to spot icebergs. And why are they squinting? Because someone borrowed their binoculars and did not give them back. So by the time they spot danger and scream, iceberg right ahead, it's already too late.
Wow.
Bad idea number four. We call this one hard a starboard. So the moment Fleet and Lee, the two lookouts, spot the iceberg, first officer named William Murdoch makes bad idea number four happen. He gives the order to turn the ship hard a starboard in an effort to avoid the iceberg, to turn away from it. And this causes the mountain of ice to scrape along the entire side of the ship's hull, flooding the first five compartments. And as we already heard, they don't have any roofs in addition to that. So if Murdoch had simply kept the ship on a straight course Titanic would have hit the iceberg head on, crushing maybe only the first two of its compartments. And this would have crippled the ship, of course, but experts say that the Titanic would have survived the impact with virtually no loss of life. Final bad idea. A few lifeboats. I think we know this one.
Yeah. People don't know that, though. You know, this is why I like your book, because I really like your book. Because do you know people don't know that? They don't know the back.
I thought that everybody knew the Titanic did not have enough lifeboats.
Well, thanks to the movie, they sort of got the hint of it, but they don't really understand the magnitude of not having enough boats. And what a blunder.
They were so cocky, Dr. Pat, when they designed this darn thing. It was unsinkable. You know, we hear about the unsinkable Molly Malone character. They thought the boat was unsinkable. So it only had enough lifeboats for half of the people on board. So, as I said, over 1,700 people perished, including Captain Edward Smith, no relation to me, thank God, and ship architect Andrews. And both of the lookouts died. Murdoch also lost his life. But Bruce Ismay, the owner of the unsinkable Titanic, somehow managed to climb into a lifeboat and save himself. So a completely avoidable incident that involved 1,700 people dying under very, very difficult conditions.
Now, I have a modern-day blunder that I'll talk about at the end of this interview, and it's right in the headlines today. And
okay.
I think it's a modern-day blunder, and I think we're going to get more and more of these. But outside of the Titanic, you have some of the funniest things. Let me ask you this. I was struck by some of the Hollywood blunders, if I could have you comment.
There's a lot of them.
Right. Tell us about the blunder of Nick Nolte. You know, that blunder of him not taking that role. Holy cow, Nick.
Well, Nick Nolte decided to turn down the now legendary movie role of Indiana Jones, if you can even begin to imagine that. So this is 1980, and he just simply refuses to, as we say, don the fedora and crack the bullwhip, and he declines the choice role of Indiana Jones in Lucas and Spielberg's modern classic, Raiders of the Lost Ark, with a hearty thank you from Harrison Ford. So instead of assuming the mantle of the two-fisted Nazi-fighting professor, Nolte decides instead to star in the long-since-forgotten movie Heartbeat. I don't think anybody even remembers that one.
Nope.
Now, ironically, just 3 years earlier, Nolte had already lost the iconic role of Han Solo in Lucas's Star Wars, A New Hope, to the aforementioned Harrison Ford. And it's the same Harrison Ford who goes on to make a total of four highly successful Indiana Jones-related films over the next three decades. And all told, the quartet of indie movies earns over $1.9 billion worldwide and makes Ford one of the three most successful actors in box office history. And a little cherry on top of that cupcake for Nick Nolte was he was also director Richard Donner, who just unfortunately passed away recently. He was his first choice to play the Man of Steel, Superman, in the 1978 movie Superman. But unless he's bypassed under pressure from the studios to cast a beefier, more handsome actor, and he's bypassed in favor of the relatively unknown Christopher Reeve, who, as we say in the book, quickly catapults to fame and fortune faster than a speeding bullet. So Nolte had some ups and some downs. He's an interesting character. I know some people, because I'm south of Hollywood, have done a lot of work up in Hollywood. He's a little bit all over the place. Let's put it that way. You're into the psychology thing. I don't know what it is about some actors where they at times are self-destructive and maybe they think they don't deserve the success. But I'll tell you this, in the 1980s, between Nicolas Cage and Nick Nolte, those to me were the two best character actors out there. And you could argue that really both of them kind of self-destructed over time.
Yeah. What I love about Nicolas Cage is that he's like the Energizer Bunny, I think. He just keeps ticking. And what I mean by that is, you know, all of these, what do we call, Hollywood calls them B-type movies. He's in a million of them. So for whatever reason, he is out there just chugging along. You know, every time you turn around,
you,
right?
Yeah, I can tell you what the reason is.
All right, tell me.
Because that's one of the stories in the book, too. And what we had, the title of this story is Dinosaur Helps Bring, let me just find it real quick here. Dinosaur Helps Bring Actors' Finances to the Brink of Extinction. And this goes back to Nicolas Cage, goes back to 2007. And here he is the king of spendthrifts. He's by this time in 2007, he's bought a jet, 2 yachts, 3 castles,
oh,
the Canadian
yeah.
Islands, a gaggle of mansions, 50 cars, including the Shah of Iran's $495,000 Lamborghini, and a comic book collection worth $1.6 million. But Dr. Pat, at this point, that he really needs above all other worldly possessions is a 67-million-year-old dinosaur skull. So the, as we say in the book, the Raising Arizona star,
oh my gosh,
raises the auction ante and outbids fellow thespian Leonardo DiCaprio to snare this prehistoric relic for $276,000. And we say, that's a bonehead move, right? But really, the dino dung hits the fan when it's realized that Cage already owes the government over $6 million in back taxes.
Oh, my God.
And his weird pirouette, as we say, into paleontology, has helped incur the wrath and the notice of the IRS. So as the tax man closes in on Cage, the actor reverses course in turning his years-long buying spree into a bargain basement sell-off, and he lists his Bel Air mansion for tens of millions of dollars less than its original price. He then loses hundreds of thousands of dollars on the sale of the 3 castles, one of which he only spent one night in. And also his beloved Superman comic book collection goes up for sale.
Oh, my gosh.
So what happens at the end of it all is he still earns a cool $40 million a year, and he hired a new business manager in 2008, and we'll say, with a nod to his alcohol-addled Oscar-nominated role in Leaving Las Vegas, he reportedly pledges to take a more sober approach to spending.
Oh, my God. Well, you know, it's interesting. I want to go through a couple of these with you because, first of all, I love the way you divide the book. But before we do, let's tell folks how they can get their copy of the book, if you would, please.
Sure.
Because
sure.
This is really the coolest thing to really – I could see sitting around and having a conversation about some of these and then asking your friends, you know, what are some of the blunders that you've seen in your life? But how do people get a copy of the book? And then I want to talk about a couple that you have in the book where
sure.
you start to talk about, you know, beyond war strategies that bond. I want to talk about a couple of these because some of them are so obvious. You have to ask yourself – why would they do that, right?
Why would they do it? Sure. You know, it's what were they thinking? Is
what were they thinking?
Underlying theme of the book. It's insane. But you can get the book. The printed book has done well. It's available still on Amazon, as all books are. It's the law. You know, if you have a book, it has to be on Amazon, apparently. It's also available at Barnes & Noble and find retailers everywhere. The audiobook, which is new, it's only been out about a month and a half, is available on audible.com, again, Amazon, iTunes, and at 100worstideas.com.
Awesome. Okay, let's talk about one or two, or let's just do one of these, because there's a couple of others in here I just want to talk to you about. There's so many in the book for people to enjoy on their own. But some of the war blunders, I mean, gosh, are you still scratching your head?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, you know, do you have one in particular you'd like to talk about?
Well, I have a couple.
Sure.
I think the thing I never understood was Napoleon. I was talking to a friend of mine the other day, and I said, do you know how close that part of the world came to being one country? And I think this. And then, you know, I think about the fact that one bad idea stops somebody like a Napoleon or even an Adolf Hitler. I mean, the double cross that you put in the book of Adolf Hitler. But I also think about, you know, how some of these decisions were made, right? You know, some of the strategies, right, like the bad idea, fight to the death.
Sure.
I have a friend that talks about Japan, and, you know, the bombing of Pearl Harbor was an atrocity. But the only reason that Hawaii was not completely taken over, you know, Japanese folks were looking at that and saying, is because they didn't do the third wave. But what are some of your favorite bad ideas?
Well, I'll tell you, in terms of war, you know, in the category of war strategies that are that bombs, I really like the double agent who double crosses the Fuhrer.
Yeah.
That's a good one. I did not, frankly, I feel dumb, but I didn't know anything about this before we did our research. But it's a really interesting take on the psychology of Adolf Hitler, really, when it comes down to it, and how it was played upon very intelligently by the intelligence services of both Britain and America. So anyway, it's late in World War II, and the German military intelligence learns that an Allied invasion of Europe is imminent.
Mm.
And Hitler is desperate to know where the attack is going to be, obviously. So he turns to his most trusted intelligence advisor. It's a guy named Juan Pujol Garcia. But there's a problem, as we say, with good old Juan. He's actually a double agent working for the British, codenamed Garbo. So, and he's quite the convincing actor, and I think that's why they gave him the name of an actress at that time.
Uh-huh.
But actually, so what happens is Garbo advises Hitler that American General George Patton will lead the upcoming assault and that his forces will storm the beaches at Calais. Now, anybody who knows their history knows that didn't happen. Hitler takes Garbo's advice and directs his generals to defend the shores of Calais. Well, following Garbo's advice is not a good idea. On June 6, 1944, the real Allied beachhead assault begins miles away in Normandy. And even as that's happening, Hitler is still trusting Garbo's opinion. He continues to direct his tanks to defend against an invasion of Calais that never happens. And within a year, Hitler's dream of world domination turns into a nightmare of defeat. And thanks in part to the phony story of a phony advisor with a phony name. And the postscript on that one, Dr. Pratt, is after the war, Garcia's Nazi credibility was still intact. Garbo was still thought to be a great advisor, even though the invasion of Normandy he didn't quite predict properly. And he's awarded Germany's Iron Cross, that's the highest honor. Simultaneously, he's covertly knighted by the Queen of England. And as a result, he's thought to be the only person in history to be jointly honored as a hero by each opposing side in the war.
Wow. You know, I'm thinking about these things, and I'm really struck by, you know, how little we know and how so many of these could have really changed the landscape of things, right? You know, I mean, there's so many things in here that you've gone and did a lot of homework about. You know, of course, you know, we're looking at certain things that now we're trying to undo, like, you know, amalgams in our mouth and things like that. But, you know, for you, what do you think of one of the most contemporary, you know, worst ideas are? If you're looking at the world and you could say to yourself right now, I wish I could have put this in the book, and maybe when I do part two book, this will be in the book.
Well, there were quite a few, and we try to not be political in the book, but I thought there was quite a few bad missteps over the past 4 years in terms of the way we handled COVID, in terms of the way we challenged the election results and things like that. But what I'd love to tell you about, and this is, I don't know if this falls under the category of contemporary because it goes back to 1988. But
well, that's pretty contemporary.
It's pretty funny. At least it's not World War II or skinny-dipping presidents in the 1700s. But we call this one How to Lip Sync a Music Career, and sync is S-I-N-K. So the bad idea here is to create a pop music group led by two singers who cannot sing. And the genius behind this, as we say, is Frank Farian, who is a uber-successful German music producer, and as I say, this goes back to 1988. So Farian is looking for the next big thing in music, and he's scouring the 1980s Berlin club scene. And he happens upon models, male models, Fabrice Morvan and Rob Pilatus, tearing up the dance floor. And to most onlookers, they're really no more than hunky, prancing boy toys. But to Farian, they're the ideal front men for a new band. And soon the pop group Milli Vanilli is born. One problem, as I stated earlier, neither Rob nor Fab can sing. So to cover that rather glaring deficiency, Farian secretly hires professional vocalists to record all Milli Vanilli songs. And he directs Rob and Fab to lip-sync to these recordings whenever they're performing live. So Milli Vanilli takes off like a hip-hopping missile. And then just as quickly, the missile crashes. At a 1989 MTV Live concert, Rob and Fab are lip-syncing and gyrating to their monster hit, Girl, You Know It's True, when the recording skips, forcing them to repeat the same line of the song over and over. It was, girl, you know it, girl, you know it, girl, you know it. And the Milli Vanilli fraud is exposed. So outraged fans demand that the musical imposters be strung up by their dreadlocks. Dozens of lawsuits follow. Arista Records breaks their recording contract. The band's new artist, Grammy Award, is returned in shame, and their short-lived careers in disarray. Fab slips into obscurity, and sadly, Rob dies of a drug overdose in 1998. But this whole lip-syncing thing, based on the Milli Vanilli debacle, has become a pretty hot topic these days, with critics and fans excoriating everybody from Britney. I call these the three Bs: Britney, Bieber, and Beyonce, accusing them of fake singing live performance. And when you think about it, Dr. Pratt, if you're going to pay the kind of money that it costs these days to go to a concert, wouldn't it be nice if they were actually performing at that moment?
And I think that fans are really now more in tune with that than they've ever been. I think, you know, we've gone through the plastic nature of things, and now we've gone through the digital nature of things. And we are really, as fans, let's call ourselves fans if we could, we're pretty demanding now. We want to see real entertainment. You know, we're going to download your song from here. You're dropping an album, and we're downloading it from here. And, you know, but when it comes to real entertainment, especially now, people are not really, how should I say, they're a little bit impatient, and they really want to see the artistry of things now. You know, I got to give a shout-out to Pink. She never wavered. You go to a Pink concert, you watch Pink, and oh, my God, you know.
Well, she's doing that Cirque du Soleil thing. She's up in the rafters. She's hanging off wires. She's singing live. It's quite a performance.
Yeah. And, you know, I wonder, so let me give you, I know we've got to end this interview, and I want to thank you for it. There are a couple of blunders I'm seeing now, and I just wonder about them. Can we just talk blunders, perhaps, that will make your next book?
Oh, gosh, sure. You know, we did some research, and I think this will almost certainly make the next book what would be the next 100? The other 100 of the worst ideas in history. But I really like the story of New Coke, if I can get into that.
Sure.
This is Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
And we say New Coke's I've already drafted this one out, but New Coke's product launch goes from fizzy to flat. And the idea here is to change the flavor formula for the most popular soft drink on earth.
Mm.
And the geniuses here are the senior executives of Coca-Cola Company.
Right.
Back in 1985. So we're in the bubbly affluence, as we say, of the post-World War II America, and Coke is the cola preferred by 60% of the market. Yet by 1983, I believe, this pesky rival Pepsi has begun to outsell Coke among the coveted youth audience. So Coke's market share sinks to 24%, down from 60%. So their CEO, a dude named Roberto Goizeta, orders a rethinking of the company's operations top to bottom. Even Coke's Century Mill secret formula is reevaluated. So despite a generation-long reign as the world's top-selling soft drink, It's a bastion of cool-headed product stability, as we like to say. It's now sweating in the heat of competition. It's ready to change its taste. Often.
Yeah.
So researchers fan out across America, and they're armed with trial samples of new Coke. It's a slightly sweeter, more Pepsi-like take on the soda's traditional flavor, and blind taste that consumers choose new Coke over both traditional Coke and Pepsi by wide margins. Yet when they do focus groups, where you get more qualitative data, not quite so enthusiastic, but still, Coke management doesn't care. They're thirsty for a winner, as we say, and they launch the new taste of Coca-Cola tomorrow, the centennial of Coca-Cola in 1985. It's been around for 100 years at that point.
Wow.
So public reaction immediately comes from Fizzy the Flat. Within days, the company receives 400,000 distraught calls and angry letters. A psychiatrist is brought in to evaluate the tenor of the consumer calls, and he says that they sound like people mourning the death of a loved one. Even Fidel Castro says it's another example of American decadence.
Mm-hmm.
So with boycotts looming just 3 months after its historic birth, New Coke is history. And the postscript on that one, we pull it after just 3 months, after hundreds of millions of dollars invested in research, development, and marketing, they simply had underestimated the deep and abiding emotional attachment, as they said, to the original Coke. And some conspiracy theorists, and they brought back then the original Coke and basically named it Coca-Cola Classic. And some conspiracy buffs say that this was nothing more than a ploy all along to boost the sales of original Coke or Coke Classic, to which CEO Robert Goizet said, "We are neither smart enough nor stupid enough to have come up with that plan."
Yeah. Well, you know, I love some of these, and, you know, yet what I love about some of these is, like, the what if. You know, the what if mm-hmm. factor in so many of them. You know, here's one for your next book. I work for AT&T, but I work for Bell Labs. And I worked as a clerk. I'm one of these, I work my way up. But I worked in an organization where my boss had access. So I remember sitting at my desk and my boss bringing in this large thing that looked like one of the first Apple monitors, right? You know, it was very, very large, and brought it in. And I talked to my boss, and I said, wow, this is really cool. Now, this is in the 60s and early 70s. And so when you have something that looks like that before you actually have anything that looks like that, and I brought it in, and my boss said, well, what do you think of this? This is a picture phone, and this is Bell Labs now. And I said, wow, that's cool. What are you going to do with that? And he said, well, this is, instead of your phone, you're going to be able to see people. And the first picture phone, 1970, from Bell Labs. And I said to him, my gosh, that's the coolest thing. He said, we're not really going to implement it. And I said, why? The board and the executives are all men, because women would not want to be seen in their pajamas. Now, they don't know anything about women, but women that could chat on a picture phone face-to-face, I think that, to me, that is how Bell Labs and the phone company lost close to $500 million or more. Even though they'd have to go on cable that wasn't invented, can you imagine what would have happened if they just stayed with that and taken that? Now, I'm talking about the 70s, right? But that's one of them. Here's one I want to leave you with.
Sure.
The 2020 Olympic U.S. across the board blunder, not having every single athlete have their own personal human performance and mental coach, not supplying that team substitutes for their parents, not having people that can coach them on their mental fitness. And we're seeing it across the board. Simone Biles, Ledecky, we're seeing it across the board at what's happening.
Yes.
And you have to ask yourself the question, what if they would have looked at the pressure of a COVID Olympics, athletes that have never been away from their support system and their families, and what the impact is on a Simone Biles, who literally is carrying the weight of the world, who had to take herself out because she couldn't mentally see herself in the exercise. I think that is a blunder that we're going to see more of as we move forward. You know, it's...
Wow.
not really looking at what these athletes were going to face. What they were going to face and not doing something about it as the United States of America.
Yeah, I think so often in athletics in particular, but I'm sure it's true in business too, is particularly in athletics, we look at the physical training of an athlete and we concentrate on giving them the facilities and the nutritional advice and the when to work out, what weights to use, and how to stretch, all that type of stuff. How often, though, do we really look at the mental side of things? And as I get older in my life, particularly in athletics, but again, I think it applies to many areas of life, if you don't have the psychological part of it together, if you don't have the mental acuity, strength, resilience, foresight, whatever you want to call it, then that is at least half the equation. So we are really only training athletes for, in my estimation, half or maybe less than half of what they need in order to be successful. And I think that's what you're referring to.
Yeah. Can I give you a technical blunder, which I don't know it is, so I'm going to say right out of the gate, you have to fact check this for me.
Sure.
Technical blunder. Microsoft buys Skype and doesn't take it to the level of video interface. Oopsie.
And Zoom does.
Here's Zoom. That's got to be in
well,
your book.
Sure.
That has got to be in your next book.
That is a good one. And also Time Warner acquiring AOL at some point. That was not great. That's one for the book as well. I'd have to research that a little bit further to know for sure. But if you go back even further, I mean, Bill Gates and Microsoft were given pretty much a free pass to success when IBM decided that they weren't interested in software. The future was hardware.
Yeah.
Computer hardware was the way of the future, IBM believed. And they said, okay, little Bill, you can go and do whatever you want with the software. Just go ahead. And then his company soon eclipsed IBM, which you could argue is out of the computer business and now basically into the business consulting business because of that.
Yeah. Look, so many we can talk about, and I know that you try so hard to stay away from these particular political blunders, but my friend said to just talk to you in this short interview and say, hey, what do you think of them not repealing the filibuster thing? And my friend's like, what do you think will be the blunder of this four-year administration and the filibuster? And I'm not going to have you answer that. I know it's kind of like a politically hot, but my friend's that has got to be the blunder of blunders.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll throw in the Electoral College not being
That's got to be the blunder of the century, that.
Well, the blunder of the origins of America, you would say, because that's what was written into the Constitution way back when, and my gosh, I mean, it was designed to, I get it, it was well-intended, but I don't think anybody saw the consequences that could arise from it later on, where it was always there to protect the few against the tyranny of the many, but now it's the tyranny of the few against the many.
Yep.
And that's, that's what happened. So, a lot of stuff, a lot of bad ideas are still floating around. So I guess it's time for me to start writing more of these 100 worst ideas in history.
Yeah, I think you should. And, Michael, thank you so much for writing this because it really gets you to think. And that's really what we've been talking about today. I mean, this is really getting us to think. And some of these I'm just completely fascinated by. And I love the way you wrote the book. I mean, I was especially drawn to the way that you separated these ideas, thinking from air, land, and sea. And, I'm just so in awe about how you found some of these things and what they mean.
Yeah, that's a lot of digging.
Yeah.
Well, we went to a crazy place that some people might have heard of called a library.
Oh, my God,
listeners are familiar with this building where it's very quiet. There's books.
Yeah.
But that we spent a lot of time in traditional libraries and online for 3 years, and that's the result.
And we haven't even talked about what I think is one of the greatest atrocities we still have, and that is when you talked about 1939 and the Swiss chemist Paul Mueller creating DDT. I mean, that is something we just still have not really gotten our minds wrapped around as it is being used in some countries.
We call it the pesticide that commits homicide.
That's
really what it ends up doing. It kills a whole bunch of people, and all of us, I won't go through the whole story, but all of us still have trace elements of DDT in our bodies. And
absolutely.
Who knows what it's done to us from a mental health and physical health standpoint after all these years.
Well, look it. Let's leave everybody with this. There's a scene from The Godfather. I don't know which Godfather. I think it's Godfather 2. And I grew up in a Mediterranean family. And so this is a scene from my grandfather who came over here, who was a farmer, and grew some farms right there in the Bronx, had his own little shack and, like, the farm thing, like in these little beds. And there's a scene from The Godfather, if you remember it, you know, where Marlon Brando puts the orange or whatever the heck he has in his mouth, and he's running around at the kid, but he's holding a can. And it's a spray can.
It's a pesticide.
It's a pesticide can. And those of us that remember that is, many of our grandfathers had that can of DDT and lived and breathed by it.
Yeah. Oopsie. And not to put too fine a point on that story, but doesn't that character drop dead right after?
He drops dead right there. He does.
There you go.
I forgot about that.
DDT at work.
He drops dead with the can in his hand. Oh, boy, that's a message.
He's spraying the can. The little kid sprays it on him after he falls down. My gosh, there's no clearer indication of what DDT does than that movie.
Oh, my gosh. Michael, what's your personal message? What do you want to leave us with? And again, tell folks how to get a copy of the book. We didn't even touch some of these, but please tell folks.
Oh, I think there's probably 93 others that we haven't even gotten to. I guess what my father always used to say is, hey, can you take 30 more seconds of thought before you do something? And often that's all it takes is another 30 seconds of, gee, should I or shouldn't I do this thing, this idea I have in my head? Should I execute on it or not? And I would say in many, many, many of the cases in the book, if people had just stopped and thought just a little bit longer, they would have maybe arrived at a different course of action based on their ideas. So that's my advice to your listening audience there. And in terms of the book, we can get it at Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, many fine retailers, the audiobook, Audible.com, Amazon, and iTunes, or 100worstideas.com.
And how do people find out more about you?
You can find out all about me on 100worstideas.com. There's a bio section to that website. Also, some of the reviews we've gotten are there, as well as some interviews we've done on TV and radio and other places. So, yeah, I think that's a good place to learn about me. There's also a 100 Worst Ideas Facebook page and Instagram and, you know, what all the kids look at and care about these days.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to see that picture thrown in there, and I can give you the skinny behind it. The skinny that nobody knows, right?
Oh, please.
Women would not want to be seen in their bathrobes. That was the most intelligent decision a board of directors could possibly make.
Yeah.
All they needed to do was ask us.
Not only, but lazy and stupid on top of it.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. And I could go on and talk to you a little bit even more about my role at Bell Labs and then asking me about caller ID. When the boy asked me about caller ID because they didn't think caller ID was a good idea because women wouldn't want their numbers to be seen. And I said to them, are you kidding? Absolutely. We want to know. You
got
to remember what year this was. This was the year of we think we know women. The world has changed.
Yes.
Yeah.
It has.
I still don't.
For the better, I would hope.
I just never got pointy high heels. Make sure you put that in your book. Who the heck came up with the pointy high heel stiletto?
Pointy high heel. Well, certainly a guy. But we do have fashion frock ups, as we call it in the book.
You do. I love it.
Among it is wooden shoes.
Oh my God, I love that.
Wooden shoes. The clip on tie. The toupee. There's all kinds of the corset. There's all kinds of stuff in there that we have pictures of and get into a little bit.
Yeah.
So it's fun. It's fun for the whole
family. And I want to leave you with this. One of the worst ideas, I think, in the comic book Marvel franchise. Are you ready for it?
Yeah.
Got to be the worst. I think we're all okay with, Captain Marvel, Captain America disappearing. I don't know, like he got old and there he went. I think we were cool with that.
Sure.
I think we even were cool with, you know, Brie Larson playing Captain Marvel, you know, and of course they're going to reprise that role. But I think we are going to be very unforgiving about killing off Black Widow and then doing a movie, a blockbuster movie about Black Widow, because who does not love Scarlett Johansson, Black Widow, Marvel Blunder.
Yeah, it's kind of like a sequence there to kill somebody and then have a movie afterwards. As if they're still alive.
Yeah. Thank
Hollywood
you so much.
With bad ideas.
Yeah. That one happens to be making a lot of money, that Black Widow movie. It's one of my favorites. Thank you so much for everything you're doing.
Thank you.
All right. Keeping us laughing, everybody. This is our good news interview. Michael Smith, 100 of the worst ideas in history. He's already writing the third book, second book, all the books. We'll see you in a minute, everybody. We'll be right back.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and not necessarily those of KKNW, its management, or other advertisers. Contests are the responsibility of the host of this program, and not KKNW. This is Alternative Talk 1150 AM, KKNW Seattle, and KNUC 98.9 HD3 Seattle.
And good Tuesday to you. Benny Mathers here for a look at your Alternative Talk AM 1150 traffic update for around the town. Over on I-5 northbound around the West Seattle Bridge is heavy up into downtown Seattle. It breaks free just before the 520 and Del Mar Drive. Over here on the east side, stop-and-go traffic on I-90 eastbound just before you reach the Cold Creek Parkway. And 405 northbound, still through those S-curves up through the Kennedale Hill, is heavy stop-and-go issues through that construction zone and Northeast 44th Street. Stay tuned coming up next. After the news and weather, it's another hour of the Transformation Talk Radio Network. This time, it's Coffee with the Universe and Laura Goldstein. Be calm, collected, and confident every day.
NBC News Radio, I'm Lisa Taylor. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down more than 500 points as Tuesday's sell-off picks up steam. Stocks opened sharply lower after retail sales fell more than expected in July. The S&P 500 and NASDAQ were also down more than 1% amid growing fears of a global economic slump. The number of coronavirus cases in the U.S. is surpassing 37 million since the start of the pandemic. News outlets also confirm over 626,000 people have died as a result of the virus. Over 208 million cases of COVID-19 have been confirmed around the world. New York City is pushing hard to get the word out about the indoor coronavirus vaccine mandate that is in effect starting today. Scott Pringle reports.
Mayor de Blasio says about 100 vaccine pop-up sites will be at gyms and restaurants. So theoretically, you can show up, and if you're not allowed in because you're not vaccinated, you might be able to get that first dose right nearby and come back.
You want to experience all the greatness in New York City? You can. All you have to do is be vaccinated. Just that first dose gets you in the game.
Folks need to show their vaccine card or proof through the city or state's vaccine phone app for indoor dining, gyms, and performance venues. The city has hundreds of people now going to neighborhoods to educate folks about the vaccine mandate and a $10 million ad campaign. Right now it's education, and in mid-September the mandate will be enforced.
The Defense Department is assessing earthquake damage in Haiti. Spokesman John Kirby told reporters the Pentagon is sending 8 helicopters and a joint task force to Haiti to start providing humanitarian efforts.
USS Arlington, a Navy amphibious ship, will be getting underway today as well, and we'll have embarked on it 2 MH-60 helicopters. It also will have on board a surgical team and a landing craft mechanized to be able to move things ashore.
He expects field hospitals to be set up by late this week. Haiti was slammed by Tropical Storm Grace after suffering a deadly earthquake Saturday. Monday, its civil defense officials raised the death toll to more than 1,400 and said nearly 7,000 people had been injured. You're listening to the latest on NBC News Radio.
Need a break from the sound bites and the talking heads? Do you want information you can actually use? Information that'll change your life for the better? Then listen to the Del Walmsley Radio Show. Del will show you how to retire in 2 to 5 years. Your age doesn't matter. Turn off the pundits and turn on the passive income. Tune in to the Del Walmsley Radio Show.
Tune in every Monday at 8 a.m., Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Fridays at 5 p.m., and Thursdays at noon, right here on KKNW.
Let's go ahead and take a look now for Alternative Talk weather outlook for Tuesday. Well, we'll see some morning clouds and a little bit of light showers mixed in there as well. mostly cloudy skies for most of the day today. We'll see clearing by tonight. High temperatures around 72 degrees, low temperatures around 60. For Wednesday and for Thursday, the sunshine returns. High temperatures back on the ups to the upper 70s to low 80s in selected areas, with mostly clear skies through the overnight. Low temperatures in the low 60s.
The views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of KKNW, its management, or other advertisers. This program is sponsored by Dr. Pat Vasily and Transformation Talk Radio.
How do you start your day? Are you focused, energized, and tuned in to your higher self? Or do you wake up anxious, unmotivated, and already overwhelmed by your giant to-do list? Welcome to Coffee with the Universe with Laura Goldstein, where we'll have inspiring and practical conversations around how to reverse daily struggle and show up calm, collected, and confident instead. As a psychotherapist, spiritual advisor, yoga teacher, and influential speaker, Laura will discuss all things morning routine for increased productivity, mental clarity, greater connection with self, and better decision-making. So grab your favorite cup of joe and come sit down with Laura. Coffee with the Universe starts now.
Hello and welcome to Coffee with the Universe. I'm Laura Goldstein and I am your host for the show. Why Coffee with the Universe? Well, how you start your day sets the tone and foundation for the rest of your day. So when you have a morning routine, a little ritual for yourself, that sets you up to be grounded, connected to your higher self, calm, then the rest of your day carries with that energy. The opposite is to start your day all frazzled and running out the door like a bull in a china shop, but then that just sets the day for a lot of stress, tension, and anxiety. So welcome to Coffee with the Universe. Today, we are going to be talking about the mind. The mind is a brilliant tool, but it also is not a very good coach. And we typically ask the mind for all kinds of advice, from who we should marry, where we should go on vacation, what our future will look like, and this is not really what the mind is designed for. So in this episode, I really want to talk about how it can lead you on this wild goose chase. I want to talk about what the mind really is designed for and how can you can really harness the strength of your mind as a tool, and some things that you can do to stop allowing your mind to be in control and run the show. All right, before we get started, just a little housekeeping. Normally, this is a live call-in show. However, at the time that you are listening to this, I'm going to be in Batumi, Georgia. No, not the state of Georgia, but the Republic of Georgia. I don't know about you, but I actually had to go and look up where it was because I was like, where the heck is the Republic of Georgia? And apparently it's on the sea, so it is nice. However, it does border some countries that are not so nice. So anyway, we are not doing any call-ins in this episode, so it's just myself and my producer, Edvin, who could probably tell you better where Georgia is than I can, right? Because you're kind of from that region, yes?
Oh, I'm from southeastern Europe, but Georgia's closer to the Middle East, so.
Oh, okay. Okay, I knew like you are Europe. What do you consider yourself European from like heritage?
Well, yes. I am Slavic. I was born in Remscheid, Germany, which is just on the outside of Frankfurt. But I am from Bosnia. So it's a former Yugoslavian country. I'm like one of those puppies that you get at the puppy mill and there's like, yeah, you don't even know what kind of breed they are.
Well, and I think wasn't Georgia part of so just a disclaimer, I was like a C- history and geography student. So But I felt like Georgia was part of what was known as Russia and just kind of separated.
To be honest, I'm not that sure. I always knew that Georgia was a country, and I was like, oh, there's a Georgia in the United States as well. But I'm not too, sure of their history.
Yeah, I'm not either, but I guess I'm going to find out. I'll find out. A couple of years ago, we went to Azerbaijan, and it was the same thing. I'm like, where the hell is Azerbaijan? So I found out exactly where that was, in a cool little country, very modern, very secular, even though it's predominantly Muslim. But it was really interesting. I was like, who would have thunk? I had no idea. So this will be an experience for me. But anyway, as everybody's listening to this, that's where I will be, and I'll have a much better clue as to where I am in the world as you are listening to this. All right, so let's talk about what we want to talk about today, which is the mind. The reason why I wanted to discuss it is because I have found increasingly over the years, especially as I dove more into yoga philosophy and started teaching yoga, I realized that my mind was just like, it was really messing me up. At the time, I was trying to find my purpose, and it was like I was racking my brain to find the answers. You know, what is my purpose, and what do I want to be doing, and how will I get there, and what should it look like? And I kept kind of running after things. Like, I would have this great idea, and I'd be like, oh, let me go, you know, learn more about tarot and get, you know, some tarot certifications. I really like this. I'm really good at it. And so let me go for that. And I would like run towards that. And then I would garnish some, I guess, skills from that was helpful. But then I was still left with that questioning, you know, always questioning, what was my greater purpose? What am I meant to be doing with my life? So then I'd have another brilliant idea. Like, my mom would be like, oh, you need to go and get an Akashic Record certification. So I'd be like, oh, this is fantastic. And, you know, I would run after that, and I would get that. It'd be a great tool, and it would really help me and serve my clients. But then I was, again, left with that flat feeling of what, you know, this really isn't it. This isn't the thing. And what I learned as I was going through this process, and again, getting more into yoga and yoga philosophy, is that I was looking to my mind to solve this problem. And the problem is really not the point. It can be any problem. It could be, you know, finding, you know, the love of your life, being in a relationship. It could be related to health struggles. The point is that we're constantly trying to find and discover ways of getting what we want and solving our problems by asking our mind. And this kind of looks like, oh, you know, well, I like that. Well, what if I don't like it? You know, maybe I should do this, but, you know, maybe it's not going to really work that well for me. And do I really want to be in a cubicle all day? And do I really want to do this? Is it in my gifts? Is it my strengths? Is this really in my zone of genius? So it's like we go through what we like, what we don't like, what we want, what we don't want. And then we also ask it to, like, be our fortune teller. Gosh, what will my life be like in 5 years? I know some business people, they have like a 3-year plan and a 5-year plan. And I used to do that too. Like, I used to set out, like, you know, in 3 years, this is what my business is going to look like, and this is what my life is going to look like. I think more people now are doing that with their life too. It's kind of like my life vision for 3 years. And I don't know. Do you do that, Edwin? Do you do like life plans?
To be honest with you, I try not to plan out as much. I mean, I'll have goals rather than plans, because a lot of the times when you try to plan things, it just doesn't really work out for you. But when you set goals for yourself, small little goals that lead to a bigger goal, I think those are more achievable than trying to plan things out, in my experience, to be honest with you.
Yeah, no, I'm with you there. And I think that when we use our mind for what it's designed for, then setting goals based on achievability is precisely why our mind is there. You know, we're using it for the right purpose. But I think so many people are taught that, oh, let's have this grand vision and design your life 5 years, 10 years from now, because when you do that, you will manifest, you know, great things from the universe. And I know I say that with a little sarcasm, and I think it's because in my personal experience, I've realized that when we're using our mind to kind of create life based on what we think we want and don't want, we're almost doing ourselves a disservice because we're not allowing things to unfold in front of us. We're not taking the opportunity to say, hey, what is presented to me? And can I be open to this? Because if this doesn't look like how my mind thinks it should be and what my mind told me it should be, then I might just discount it and say, oh, yeah, no, that's not for me, or not even pay attention to it, but I might be missing out on something super important or maybe even a gift that the universe is delivering to me. So I feel like when we use our mind to try and predict our future or create this idea of what it should be, then again, if it doesn't turn out how we want, there's like this great disappointment. Like somehow I failed to create this vision for myself. And I'm not saying like don't ever have like a vision or some semblance of direction. I mean, we all need to have some semblance of direction. I'm just saying, what are you doing with your mind? Are you asking your mind to plan your future and give you guidance as to what it thinks it should be like? Or are you using your mind to process information like it was designed to do? And we'll get a little bit more into that later. But I want everybody to understand how our mind can really just lead us on a wild goose chase. Because to be honest, our mind has no idea. When you ask your mind, should I marry Bob or Susan? It doesn't know. I mean, your mind is a development of your experiences. It's just a storehouse of what you've already experienced, starting from when you were a child, as well as stored judgments about those experiences. Some are good and some are bad. And here's the kicker. It doesn't matter whether these experiences are good or bad. It still does the same, it still has the same detrimental effect. So for example, let's say, you know, as a kid, you grew up in a home where, you know, your parents were always fighting and arguing, things like that. You've now stored the information about, you know, marriage is not fun. It's not good. There's a lot of arguing. Therefore, as an adult, oh, I'm never getting married. I mean, I saw what it was like as a kid. I'm not going to do that. So your mind is trying to solve this problem of, as a child, I didn't understand what a healthy marriage looked like. So therefore, I'm going to just try and avoid it. And here's what you should do based on this experience. And the same goes for like a positive event. Let's say your parents had the perfect marriage, and now as an adult, you can never keep a relationship because you are looking for that 100% perfection and a soulmate, and oh my gosh, it has to be like this. If it's not like this, then it's not a meaningful, good relationship. So our mind, again, is trying to solve our problem of, hey, I'm lonely, I want to be in a relationship with someone, but based on only what it's experienced. That's all that it knows. So when you're trying to solve a problem from the chaos of only that you know, then you're just going to be kind of stuck in that chaos. There is a quote. I can't remember who it's from. I think it's, is it Einstein? I don't know, Edvin, you might know, where it's like you can't solve a problem from the, you know, source of its creation. Is that Einstein? I don't know.
I'll look into that. I'll see if that is Einstein. I don't know, because I'm not sure. I'm not honestly sure, to be honest.
It's like, who was that? I mean, it's like, I know I can see that vividly, but it's like you can't solve the problem from the place of its creation. So, but that's so true, and that's what we're doing to our mind. We're constantly trying to seek advice from it.
It was Einstein, by the way. It was we can't solve problems by using the same kind of thinking we used when we created them.
Oh, ding ding. Okay, got it. All right. So my brain, my mind that is actually stores useful information did work in this case. Okay. So that's basically what I was kind of trying to get to in terms of just understanding that your mind can only do what you ask it to based on the resources that it's had. And also, have you noticed how, like, you can change your mind in an instant? Here's another reason why it's not a good idea to seek life advice from your mind. Because one day, like, you love Brussels sprouts. The next day, you hate Brussels sprouts. And we know this. I mean, just think about things that you like, and then all of a sudden, like, you've changed your mind. Things that you liked when you were 20 years old, you may not like now. I used to like going out and, you know, hanging out with my friends and going dancing and stuff, and now not so much. I would rather be snug as a bug in a rug by 9 p.m. That's what happens when you get old. But our minds change. What we like one day is not what we like another day. So there really isn't any legitimate consistency there. Kind of leading us then to being on a roller coaster, like, oh, one day I'm headed this direction, and oh, this isn't so good, it's not working out, okay, now I'm going to try this direction, and that's going to be awesome because my mind said so, and I had a really good experience here, and then all of a sudden, well, it doesn't really feel right, maybe I should go do this, and pretty soon we are all over the place. And it really just triggers us into a place of anxiety, not really being confident in our decisions, and really being doubtful about the direction that we are going. All right, I am getting cues here that we need to take a break. So we're going to do that. And when we come back, I want to talk about what the mind is really for. All right, so if we're not going to use it for advice, let's actually use it for what it was designed to be used for. I will see you after the break.
You're driven, and it totally shows. Your career is taking off. You're killing it in the mom game. But did your health needs make it on the plate this week? Tune in to Boss Up Babes, where Carissa Atkins helps babes show up, boss up, and thrive. Every second and fourth Tuesday at 12:30 p.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Become the boss babe you were meant to be. To sign up for one of Carissa's group coaching programs, visit 365DailyHustle.com.
Are you ready to experience full body system wellness? Tune in to the Empower Me Show with Pam Bright, a spiritual toolbox for your life. Embrace the fullness of who you are as a spiritual being, having a human experience. Pam Bright is a multidimensional healer, light language channel, energy intuitive, and spiritual transformation coach. Join her for a rich conversation about how to unlock all your spiritual gifts. Mondays at 3 p.m. Pacific on Transformation Talk Radio.
Have you known that you're on a soul path but often wondered why you don't have the insight of how to go from here to there, or whether or not what you're doing is going to take you to where you want to go in your soul's journey? Damayante is the show for your soul. Damayante speaks to your soul, connects with your soul, and shines a light for your soul. Damayante, the show for your soul with Sarah Main, brings you insights and a pathway to your soul's journey on TransformationTalkRadio.com.
The Truth Is Funny, Shift Happens, with monthly guest host Karen Bettman. Tune in for powerful conversations about health and wellness. Karen brings unique insights rich with humor and science to her discussions with experts in medicine, movement, psychology, spirituality, and so much more. Don't miss Karen on The Truth Is Funny every third Wednesday at 8 a.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com. For more information about Karen, visit KarenBetton.com.
Welcome back to Coffee with the Universe. Today we are talking about the mind. Oh, the mind. How wonderful it can be, how frustrating it can be, and how it can take us all over the place and leave us feeling doubtful, confused, even when some days we feel really confident because, you know, it's like right on and I'm feeling good and my mind is really just pumping me up and I'm excited. And the next day we're like, oh, I don't know. I don't know what I should do. So this episode is all about the mind. In the first segment, we talked a little bit about how the mind is not really suited to give us advice and really help us with our life promise because it doesn't know the answer. And before I talk about how to solve your life problems, like what's a better way of doing it, I want to really help you understand what your mind is created for. Now, in a lot of spiritual communities, the mind and the ego are often the same kind of like lumped together. And while they can fall in the same category, when I talk about the mind here, I want to make it a little bit neutral because ego does tend to have a bad rap. You know, it's the part of us that's very into I and me, and I want to be better than, and I want to be important. And our ego is not going away. So as much as you would like to banish your ego to someplace far, far away, we do have it. And it's there. And it's okay. You don't have to listen to it, but it is there. However, our mind can also include like our brain functioning. So that's why I really wanted to kind of leave the ego out of it and just focus on, you know, our mind, our thinking process, our thought process, what is that designed for? So if you think about it, the mind is actually a really great tool. It's like a computer. Think about what we do with our mind. We process information. We weigh pros and cons. We keep track of time. We calculate to the extent that you can still calculate math in your head.
We also have storage, by the way. There's a memory.
Yeah. So it is. It's like a computer. And when you are wanting to use your mind in the way that it's designed for, it's a good idea to say, hey, would I ask this to my computer or what I would expect my computer to do this? And two, we have like these synopses, like computers run logic, right? All these programs are all logic-based. If this, then that, and that's what our mind does. However, would you go in front of your computer and like open up a search box and say, should I marry Bob? You know, what would happen? Probably nothing. Or you might get a bunch of documents in there with like the word Bob in it or Mary. Better yet, would you Google, should I marry Bob? What would you get? Not the answer you're looking for, probably a bunch of like wedding websites, wedding dresses, wedding advice, you know, getting married, sob stories about getting married, who knows? I don't know. What do you find out? And then Google, should I marry Bob and see what happens? I am curious.
Yeah, let me do that really quick. I'm curious, too.
Should I marry Bob?
Should I marry Bob? Is he a good guy?
It'd be interesting.
It just gives you blogs about people, Bob and Linda Belcher, and their marriage calls. Very unrelated. Yeah. It's very creepy.
Right. Well, and that's when we're asking our mind, should we do this? Should we do that? That's exactly what we're doing. It's like imagine Googling, should I go on vacation? Should I have three kids? What, you know, like, would you Google, what will my life be like in 3 years? It's like, who knows what you would get.
You'd get like a generator or something, or like a test. You'd probably have to take like one of those personality tests to see where you'd be. That's my best guess.
Oh, yeah. Where will you be in 3 years? Take this quiz. I those things are such a time suck. You're like, oh, gee, what Star Wars action figure am I? Let me take the quiz.
They take way too long. It's like 30 minutes for an answer that you can get from like a friend. Like your best friend can just tell you where you'll be in like 5 years.
And you're like, oh, yeah.
Great use of my time. Yeah.
Yeah. So our minds are not really the source of our inner wisdom. It's not our higher self. It's not an actual source of like wisdom. And I know that, and really when we start wondering like what our future is going to be like and should I do this and should I do that, it's almost like a manifestation of the dysfunctional part of our mind. Because when we are using our mind like should I don't know, what's the right choice, it's really because we're afraid of failure in making the wrong choice. So by trying to use our mind to solve a problem that the mind has dysfunctionally created, it's not good. It just, you know, leads us down this path of, I don't know what, like non-answers, confusion. And it makes you like, I think I was just getting so frustrated with myself. I don't know if like you all get irritated with yourself, but sometimes it's like I just get over myself. I'm like, seriously, I have like worked myself up into a frenzy today. I have, you know, put myself in the crapper just by like thinking negative thoughts. I've beaten myself up over things that I've done. Even like after these shows, like I'll finish a show and then my mind goes directly to, oh, you forgot to say this. Oh, why did you say it this way? Oh, you know what, next show you need to do X, Y, Z. It starts like giving me unsolicited advice and I'm like, wait a second, I didn't really ask for this. It's like an automatic function. So our mind is that computer that's always on. I don't know, wouldn't that be nice if we could just like in a moment make our mind go to sleep, like, okay, I'm shutting the computer screen, you're going
You know what I think that is? I think meditation. That's like a strong, strong reboot, like you're saying, for I'd like to just turn off my computer, turn it right back on, yeah? But I think meditation's perfect for that, right? It gives you that moment of, like, clarity where you're not thinking of anything, nothing's coming to your mind, where you're just giving your mind just a little reset. And I think that's important, especially if you're overriding your computer. You need to reboot it once in a while.
Yeah, and, you know, that's why I really got into Kundalini, the form of Kundalini yoga, is because it incorporated that meditative piece, but also, you know what else I found that works really well for that is the pranayama, like the breath work. The different forms of breathing. It is that way to just, you know, shut that computer screen off and reboot. And I like that you said the word reboot. That was an awesome word because, you know, like when your computer, like all of a sudden, like something freezes and it gets like stuck and you have to restart it, it's almost like it refreshes it.
Yeah, you have to reboot it, right?
Well, it's like, yeah, sometimes you're forced to. Other times, like, you can't use, like, one program because it's, like, eternally stuck. And, you know, you can do everything else, but you can't use, like, your email or something like that. And it forces you to reboot.
What's human equivalent to, like, a computer crashing? It's like, what? That could be, like, burnout, right? And once you get to that point where it's too much and then you just override and crash, essentially.
Yeah, burn. It's like, yeah, I hear those warning signs. Override. Yeah, you know what? I lost my thought. I was thinking about something.
Rebooting.
Rebooting. Also, too, I think that when we get stuck on a concept or a trajectory or a path, because our mind has said, go this way, this is what you want, this is what you're going to like, when it doesn't work out the way that we want and we feel this sense of failure and disappointment, I almost feel like that's also a reboot phase. Like, wait, here I am, I've followed my mind down this path to who knows where, stop, what am I doing? Start to kind of use your mind for a logical, okay, where am I? What are the facts right now? What is going on? And let me reboot so that I can start over, maybe like going in the different direction. But not just any direction, because again, your mind can take you there. You definitely need to use, you know, the meditation, the pranayama, some of the tools that we'll talk about in a little bit to get to that place of, okay, after I've rebooted, here's now where I want to go. And it can be challenging because the computer, the brain is always on, it's always working, the mind is always going, and meditation can be hard. You know, I remember when I first took up yoga, I thought it was like a bunch of hogwash. And I was like, are you kidding me? You know, lying here on the floor at the end for like 5 or 10 minutes, it's like my mind was like, oh, this is the biggest waste of time. Why are we here? Why are we doing this? Oh, don't forget to put raisins on your grocery list. You need raisins. And also, you know, get some more cheese. And then it goes off to something else. And it was like, this is so stupid. This is a waste of time. I could be doing something productive. So even when we are aware of the tools to use, they don't always work, because our mind is just kind of going. It's nonstop. Have you ever paid attention to your mind? Do you ever just sit and listen to what it's saying?
Yes, and I just can't stand it. It's the whole trick to meditation is like not thinking about anything, and that's probably the hardest part. And I couldn't do it for a while, and a lot of the times my mind just gets sidetracked. So the biggest thing I learned was this trick that Navy SEALs do. So they do like a breathing technique where you only focus on counting while you're breathing in and holding your breath and breathing out. So it's not that you're not trying so hard not to think, is that you are not thinking about anything except counting, just numbers. That's why people tell you to like count, you know, to 100 before you go to sleep, because you're not worrying about anything else. You're just worrying about counting, keeping your mind off everything that's going around in your life, and that's almost way too stressful. So, yeah, I try not to think as much as I can.
Too much thinking. I know people sometimes use those mala beads, their beaded necklaces, and they, when they're meditating, they just kind of count and move from bead to bead as they're like doing mantras, because it does. It's like a distraction from the mind. It gets you to focus on a single object. And when we can focus on an object, whether it's like a candle or a bead or even a mantra, it actually stops the mind from being that runaway train, because it's actually given a purpose. Like if you're sitting at your computer and you are typing or doing a task, it's busy in that process. But if you like leave it alone. And I hope your computer doesn't do this, but there's always like things running in the background, stuff that we can't see. And when you have those things running in the background on the computer, you really don't know what's going on, especially if you have a virus on the computer and it's like running amok, doing strange things on its own, maybe sending out like bulk emails with like porn links and things like that. That's not a really good idea. And our mind is the same way. I was just thinking about that computer analogy. We have the programs running in the background. We have viruses, our negative stored experiences that are stopping us from repeat experiences by saying, oh, don't go there, that's bad, that's no good. We have those in us kind of running the show, and we don't want that in the background running the show. We want it to be present, focused, concentrated on the now, and really just paying attention to the task on hand. That's really what the mind was designed for. I know people are like, oh, I multitask, I'm a multitasker, but that isn't really a thing. You know, you don't really, even on your computer, when you switch from one program to another, it's not multitasking. You might be switching from one screen to another, but it's doing one job at a time. It's either typing in Word, typing in email, one thing at a time, and that's what our mind is designed for. Okay, it is time to take another break. We talked a little bit about how to get your mind to stop talking. We'll dive more into that in the third segment, where we talk a better way to solve your problems, create more inner peace and joy. So I'll see you after the break.
Parenting isn't about perfection. I think we all know that. Parenting is about being present and honest, having compassion for your child and for yourself, communicating consciously and loving unconditionally. Tune in to the Awakened Parent Project with Susan Dolce every first and third Tuesday at noon Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Learn to be an empowered parent through the techniques of the Conscious Parenting Community. To learn more about Susan, visit SusanDolce.com.
It's time to shake out your money-making truth on Soul Wisdom Abundance with Jennifer Bloom, creating wealth from spiritual health on TransformationTalkRadio.com. This hit show is more than your roadmap to success. It's your compass to abundance, your joy, and ease. Jennifer Bloom teaches you about the soul's relationship to money and wealth, and how improving that relationship serves both you and the world. Learn more at JenniferBloom.com.
Can't get enough of Vibe Soul Radio? Join psychic medium Jamie every Thursday at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern on Transformation Talk Radio. Take a deeper look at the raw side of spirit. Nothing is off limits. Connect with lost loved ones and explore these vulnerable subjects with the compassionate guidance of psychic medium Jamie. You are not alone. Vibe Soul, Thursday at 5 p.m. Pacific, only on TransformationTalkRadio.com.
We remember a time when you could simply form a thought and it would manifest. The harmony was forgotten, but it is returning now. The Power of Inspiration and Awakening Radio with Julia Griffin on TransformationTalkRadio.com each second and fourth Wednesday at 9 a.m. Pacific will take you on adventures through the heart and spirit, exploring who we once were. This intuitive healer studied under the guidance of wolves, learning from their wisdom to master a higher frequency for a new state of mind. Visit OneTrueSelf.com.
Hello and welcome back to Coffee with the Universe, where we are talking about the frustrations of the mind, the tendency to try and have it solve our problems and give us advice, the trouble that it causes. And now we're going to dive into a better way to solve your problems, to create joy, to get it to stop irritating you with its constant chatter, because it really can be irritating. It can be your cheerleader one day, and then the next day it can tell you how much you suck. And it's exhausting sometimes listening to the mind and allowing it to make decisions for you based on what it thinks is good for you. And it honestly really has no idea. And so, right, well, before we, I wanted to just talk a little bit about the states of mind. Before we go into a little bit more into meditation, because we already talked a little bit about meditation and pranayama, what I found interesting when I started doing my yoga teacher training is we really talked about, like, what is the purpose of yoga? And in the East, I mean, in the West here, United States, we tend to see yoga as a form of exercise and, like, a way to physically become stronger, to, like, tone our abs, to tone our butt, to work, you know, like a cardio exercise, things like that. However, when you look at the Eastern philosophy of yoga, it's really the whole purpose of it is to seize the chatter and the fluctuations of the mind so that you can meditate. And I thought that was really fascinating because they see it as a completely different purpose, but it makes so much sense because if you don't operate from a calm mind, from a place of quiet, then you can't hear the self, the capital S self, the real self, communicating to you. And our mind is not our real self. And we know this because we are aware of the thoughts of our mind. If we actually were our mind and our thoughts, we would have no awareness of what we were saying. But there is a witness inside of us, that observer, that knows when our mind is off and running, that has that awareness. So yoga is about calming the mind so that we can meditate and be more in tune with ourselves. And there's a couple of different states of mind, and I just found this interesting too, so I'm sharing it with you before we kind of go back to some tools that you can use. I'm telling you this because awareness is key. The very first thing that you can do, like the most basic, fundamental, yet most important thing you can do to stop the mind is to increase your awareness of what's going on. So your mind can be in a chaotic, a fickle state, kind of like up and down and yes and no. I kind of associate this with like a little bit of feeling manic. And yes, there's mental illness, that's mania, but we also have those days where we just feel like we are all over the place and we're like a runaway train and our mind is so busy and we just can't shut it up. So there's that state. Then we also have the dull or lazy state of mind, like feeling depressed, lethargic. Oh, what is the purpose? Why should I even bother? So we have that state of mind. We then have like a partially focused mind, which is, I think, what most of us spend our current days in. It's like we're sort of kind of aware and focused on stuff, but then we're also kind of distracted by other things. We then have a one-pointed mind, one that's really good at staying focused on one object, and this is like the point of meditation. And then we have that fully absorbed mind where like the object of our mind and the observer of it are like truly one. And this is samadhi. Most of us have not gotten there yet, but hopefully we're working on it. So I just kind of thought this was interesting because it does show you how the mind changes so much and can really put you in a different state and can impact your emotions depending on like what level it's on. So just, and that's probably me because I like to geek out on this stuff. So I just thought that was worthy of a share. Okay, so let's talk about, we talked about meditation, right? Counting, focusing on an object, I'm using a mantra. That works well when meditating. And again, the point of meditating is to train the mind. Here's another quote. I don't know who said this, Evan. You might have to look it up. The mind, is it a Buddhist quote? The mind is a brilliant servant, but not a great master.
I think it's the mind is a wonderful servant, but a terrible master. Yeah.
Oh, did I get that backwards?
No, it was just verbiage, but it was basically the same thing. Yeah.
Okay. I don't know who said that. I don't know if there is a source. And it might have been like a Buddhist quote. I don't know. But it's true. You know, the mind makes a terrible master, because if you let the mind be in charge, then it just does whatever it wants. Kind of like if you got on your computer and, like, put a bunch of viruses on it so it would just start doing whatever without you controlling it, not such a good thing. We want to train it to be a servant, and the best way to do that is through meditation. Also, stop asking it what it thinks. Stop asking. So when you're trying to solve your life problems, should I marry Bob? And you're like, well, should I? And then you start like, well, you know, he's really nice and he's good looking and he's got, you know, good breasts and he's cool. He's got a good job. Doesn't have mommy issues. When you catch yourself doing that, just stop. Stop asking what it thinks. If you're, like, let's say you have a beloved best friend and you have a great time together, but your best friend gives you, like, terrible advice, would you continue to listen to him or her? Would you continue to accept advice from someone that doesn't give good advice? No. So stop asking what it thinks. When you catch yourself falling in that trap, just stop it. Say, oh, silly me, here I am asking for advice from a source that really doesn't know. I mean, would you ask directions, like, from someone on the street corner to the airport when they've never even been to the airport and have no idea? No. So stop asking what it thinks. That's number one. I think that's even, like, before meditation, I would say. Because meditation's not easy, I get it. It can be quite challenging, and it takes a lot of practice, but something that you can do right away is stop asking it and stop getting caught up in all of its verbiage and chit-chat. I don't know. Is that easy to do? I mean, I think it is. I catch myself all the time. I don't know, it may not be easy, but... Anyway, all right, so stop asking what it thinks, meditation, being aware of what is going on, and tapping into the real source of accurate information. So that is that self, that capital S self, that witness, that observer part of us that we don't always listen to. So... Edvin, how many times have you had, like, this gut instinct to do something, but you don't do it?
Oh, there's plenty of times where in my gut I feel like, oh, this would benefit me. Or, like, in the past, if I have made investments for myself, my gut tells me, yeah, but my brain just gives me the worst advice. Like you said, I don't ask my brain as that, you know, for anything really anymore. I ask other people. If I need advice, I'm like, the last person I'm going to be asking is my brain.
Oh, so you're asking the minds of other people.
Yeah, I'm like, all right, well, let's see. Maybe this person who's wiser can, you know, is more experienced. Let's see what his brain can tell me. Because I don't know what my brain can tell me half the time anymore. So
I don't know about that. I mean, if my mind is like that messed up, you know, I bet everybody else's mind is that messed up too.
Maybe. There's sometimes where I look up to, I have some role models in industries that I'm really interested in, and they are, quote-unquote, successful. But it all depends on your perspective of what's success, right? But a lot of the times I try to reach out to people that have been giving me, like you said, if someone gives you awful advice, you're not going to go back to them, right? You know, and if they do give me decent advice, maybe I'll come back and ask them for more about other things. And I only have maybe two or three people in my life. And sometimes I don't even go to my parents for advice because I don't think they can even help me with things, right? when you have some good friends that have been with you and know your struggles, you can definitely ask them for advice because they won't give you some backhanded advice that will just not really do anything for you. Yeah.
Yeah. What's interesting is that when I started doing work like with tarot and the Akashic Records, that kind of tapped into like the energy that was being presented, I started having a hard time giving people advice based on my experiences because I realized that how I do things is not necessarily how other people do things, and that my mind is biased and has these judgments based on what I experience. So it's almost like getting more into the healing arts and these intuitive modalities and becoming more aware of my mind. It almost like screwed me up as like a traditional like psychotherapist, because a lot of psychotherapy, it's not necessarily giving advice. You know, as professionals, we have, you know, this database of tools and this is, you know, how things go, and there's almost like a structure to it in some sense. I was having a hard time because I really had no idea how my clients worked. I really had no idea like the energy that was going on. So it really screwed me up in the realm of trying to give advice when I started realizing that, hey, the place that advice comes from so often is that mind, and it's not really giving that great of advice, and it's biased advice. So how in the hell am I, you know, going to do this with authenticity and accuracy? And so, too, when you're trying to tap into that gut instinct, or you're like hesitant about listening, because when we don't listen, it all goes downhill from there. When you're trying to, you know, whether it's maybe confirm that gut instinct or get clarity around it, I found that using a tool like tarot or oracle or the Akashic Records helps to create like that non-biased view of what's really going on. And something you said, Edvin, about like other people giving advice, what I think is great in asking other people is that they can give you a different perspective. Like, they can't see you're crazy. They're standing outside the crazy. So sometimes they point out things that you can't see, right?
Yeah, I think that's important. But even when I give advice, I hate to be biased. A lot of times what helps is being open-minded. But at the same time, being open-minded is a skill. I think over the years, as you get older, you become more open-minded. And to give good advice, you really need to go. You just have to know somebody. You got to know their experiences and what they're really going through, and to be as open-minded as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If that kind of like correlates with what you're saying.
Well, it is. And that leads me to being open to what life presents. Because remember, our mind doesn't really know what we want. And if we're not open to what is presented to us, then we sometimes miss out on opportunities that, you know, we could take advantage of. And so I think, too, having an open mind really helps, too. Just, like, being open to things that come your way and being open to, like, that beginner's mind, you know, really just allowing things to happen and saying, hey, you know, I don't think I'll like this, but maybe I will. And let me just be open to just seeing what happens. Let me experience it and just be open. I don't know. Best way I can put it.
Life is all about experiences. It's the only way you'll learn. If we're just a computer sitting in a room, and, you know, no one's browsing on our computer, then that computer goes to waste, right? Your brain is trying to experience as many things as possible, and then it's trying to compute what it's experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're not doing anything, you know, you're not utilizing your computer. That's how I like to look at it, since we're on that topic of our brain being a computer. Yeah.
All right. Are we at the end of our show?
Yes. We have about 30 seconds here. But
okay.
Yeah.
All right. So I go through meditation cards. I do a lot of this in my morning magic course, if you want to check that out. Anybody? CWTU.net/morningmagic. I talk a lot about these tools to quiet the mind, to get you to start the day calm, collected, and focused, to stop the chatter of the mind and start connecting to that higher source of information instead. Thanks for joining me, and I will see you next time on Coffee with the Universe. I'm here every third Tuesday of the month at 2 p.m. Eastern on Transformation Talk Radio. Thank you for joining me for Coffee with the Universe. Make sure to tune in next time as I continue to share tips and tricks to help you stop waking up anxious, uninspired, and energetically drained in the morning and feel calm, connected to your higher self, and confident instead. If you would like more information on my morning magic course, please visit www.cwtu.net/morningmagic.